Hello and welcome back to the MJA Pod. My name is Kate Swanell and I am your host. Today my special guest is Professor Jeremy Chapman, who is the Director of Renal Medicine at Westmead Hospital in Sydney. Jeremy and his co-author, Professor John Kanellis, Deputy Director of the Department of Nephrology at Monash Health in Melbourne, have written a perspective on kidney donation and transplantation in Australia, which is published at mja.com.au. Welcome to the pod, Jeremy. What's the current survival rate for a kidney transplant these days?
Well, that's a question of a bit, how long's a piece of string.
Yeah.
So if you've had if you are a standard risk recipient, let's say you're 50 to 55, you don't have heart disease, you don't have significant comorbidities, you've got a single disease, that is kidney failure, let's say from polycystic kidney disease or glomerulonephritis, and you get a living-related donor transplant from your brother or sister, mm-hmm. who is tissue type matched with you, then your one-year graft survival is about 99%, and
yep.
your five-year graft survival is probably 98%. In other words, that's the best in. If, on the other hand, you're 65 and you've got heart disease and diabetes, and you receive a kidney from a donor who was older than you, and died of a stroke and has high blood pressure and kidney mm-hmm. disease and was retrieved through donation after circulatory death rather than brain death,
yes.
then you might be looking at survival rates more like 50%. It's very variable. There is no such thing as a single number. We can produce averages, of course,
oh.
and in the paper you'll see some averages for people to understand. But the devil is in the detail and the variability is substantial.
How much better is transplant than lifelong dialysis, say?
Tenfold. Tenfold is the
yeah.
short answer. So we can look at people who are suitable for transplantation but on the waiting list and compare them with people who were suitable for transplantation and transplanted. It's still a slightly distorted picture because obviously people who don't get transplanted sometimes don't get transplanted because they become unsuitable. And so it's a sort of self-selecting process whereby the less suitable remain on dialysis and the more suitable get transplanted. But despite that, the crude numbers vary a little bit by age. So for the young, it's about tenfold. The older individuals, say 70-year-olds, the difference might be 2 to 5-fold different in survival.
Since the Organ and Tissue Authority came in, which I think was 2009, wasn't it? Something like that?
1st yes. of January 2009.
There you go. What difference has that made in the world of kidney transplants and available kidneys?
A huge difference. So the essential change was that the Organ and Tissue Authority takes responsibility, governmental responsibility,
mm-hmm.
for driving improvements in organ and tissue donation. And it places the responsibility and the resources into intensive care units. This is nothing to do with transplant programs. So the original processes, and some still run like that in other countries, organ donation is the responsibility of the transplant program. And that, it creates an inherent conflict with intensivists and an inherent concern in the minds of individuals that there is a conflict of interest. And indeed, in some countries where the salary of the transplant program is defined by the number of transplants they do, there is indeed a conflict of interest.
Yeah.
Not true in this country, of course. Nobody is dependent upon income derived from the number of transplants they do. The transfer of responsibility to intensive care was about the locus of responsibility for the care of individuals with massive and irretrievable brain death and the placement of the professional responsibility for organ donation in the intensive care environment. And that was the essential change that finalized through the development of the Organ and Tissue Agency. It was already moving in that direction, but the Organ and Tissue Agency finally cut the umbilical cord, if you like, to
yes.
the transplant programs and said, "Nah, we're in charge. It's the organ donation program, it's the intensive care units, it's the emergency departments, and it's not the transplant programs. We'll tell you when there's a donor, and then you can come along and retrieve it. But till then, it's nothing to do with you." And the intensive care units responded substantially to self-improvement processes, to improve the organ donation program, and we've gone up dramatically in that time to 50%, 70% increases in transplantations. Massive change.
And what difference has donation after circulatory death made in terms of both numbers and quality of donations?
So there are two ways in which people can donate after death. They can donate after brain death, and they can donate when support is withdrawn and their heart stops, circulatory death, the one that most people are familiar with. So donation after brain death has been, if you like, the conventional mechanism for donation, and of course is the most effective way of donating things like the heart and the very ischemia-sensitive organs. However, the technologies have got better, so that in the last 10 years, donation after circulatory death works at a clinical level for transplantation. And that is a situation where a decision has been taken by the family, by the caring doctors, to withdraw treatment. Massive brain injury, unsurvivable, but not brain dead. A reflex is still going. The corneal reflex still works on one side, or the gag reflex works on. So they don't meet the criteria for brain death. Now, there has been a fear that actually what you're doing is if you waited 12 hours, they would become brain dead.
Yes.
And then it would become a conventional donor. And a conventional donor through brain death provides more organs for transplantation than does donation after circulatory death. But in this country, that's not what's happened. The numbers of brain dead donors has increased, and up to 20% of donors are now donors after circulatory cessation. Now, those donors are more difficult from a technical point of view. The time between withdrawing support and cessation of the heart has to be within 30 minutes for some organs, 60 minutes for other organs. And sometimes that works and sometimes that doesn't. For the kidney, the ischemia that we can tolerate, relative ischemia, is higher. For the lungs, it's actually higher than we thought it was. Liver, on the other hand, the tolerance is not so good, and in particular, the bile ducts do not like ischemia. And in those transplants, we've learned that the bile ducts don't do well in these donors. So we're less able to retrieve livers from those donors who die in that manner. But it has made a difference, has increased the number of transplants. The other trend that's happened is that we have explored older and less medically fit donors. And this has set up a new and useful tension between the transplant programs and the intensive care program. Intensive care programs, here's a donor. Transplant programs, no, they don't quite meet our criteria. What do you mean they don't meet your criteria? They're perfectly well. The creatinine's fine. Yep. You should proceed. Now, I personally think that's a really healthy tension on behalf of the recipients between the intensive care programs presenting donors that are less ideal than in years gone past, and the transplant programs being challenged to allocate and transplant less ideal kidneys than we used to. And those two things happen in other countries. In Spain, a major issue that the average age of donors is much older than most countries in the world, and the duration of survival of those kidneys is, of course, much lower.
How is it decided which kidney goes to which recipient?
Now, the allocation system has been computerized for 30 years.
Right.
So there is a clear guidance for kidneys that derives from a computer system and a computer algorithm. There's no discretion in it. The only discretion is to refuse a kidney that you're
allowed.
And so the computer system has everybody who's active on the list. Everyone who's active on the list has serum placed on cross-match trays, which are distributed to all of the five laboratories around the country, so that every donor can be transplanted and cross-matched against every patient. The tissue type of the donor is tested and entered into the computer system. The computer system then has an algorithm which puts very well-matched people higher, highly sensitized or sensitized, those people with antibodies to HLA tissue type, the highest, then less well-matched. And then if we haven't got anybody who's reasonably well-matched, we default to state-based length of time waiting. We monitor that continuously. We've been able to demonstrate quite clearly, for example, that the access to those kidneys by socioeconomic status is exactly equal. It doesn't matter if you're rich or you're poor, you live in the country or you live in the city. Once you're on the list, you have exactly equal access. And that's because the computer is blind to those things. It's alive to biological things, which like matching blood group, previous tissue types that you've seen in previous transplants, and antibodies. And it allocates on that basis. And then the donor coordinators responsible for each donation have a list which goes from 1 to 10 or 1 to 20, and they start allocating at the top, and they phone the first unit, and they say, we've got a kidney here for Joe Bloggs. And then the next one, we've got a kidney here for Frieda Smith. And then the next one, if one of the first two reject the offer, go to the next one. And each one's got 20 minutes to make a decision. In that time, the transplant unit has to contact the nephrologist caring for the patient themselves, make sure they're fit, make sure they're interested in receiving it. And now this is where sometimes you've got a 69-year-old donor with diabetes and hypertension, with a creatinine of 110 and a little bit of proteinuria, and a biopsy of the kidney which shows 10% of the glomeruli sclerosed. And the offer is to a 26-year-old person who's been on home dialysis for 4 years and is perfectly well on home dialysis for 4 years. You have a discussion and you say, no, that kidney is not going to improve my quality of life, and it's not a good long-term solution for me, so yeah, I will refuse that. And it will move down the system to somebody for whom the balance of decision is in favour of accepting.
I'm chatting today with Professor Jeremy Chapman, Director of Renal Medicine at Westmead, about all things kidney transplantation. Jeremy's co-authored perspective can be found at mja.com.au. Are there any downsides to this system?
Well, yes, there are. The most difficult thing for us is that you have a young, if you like, ideal donor, male, 25, road traffic accident, which incidentally contributes only about, I think it's 15 or 12% of current organ donors. Most of them are strokes and cerebral injury. Young, ideal, fit donor, and it's allocated to the oldest person on the transplant waiting list.
Is that a waste of a kidney? To put it bluntly.
Well, it's not a waste for the individual.
Of course.
And of course, as that patient's physician, what do? You act in the best interests of the patient and you advise them to take it. And they say, thank you very much. However, the survival of older patients after transplantation is mostly dependent upon their comorbidities. And so their survival, you know, a 70-year-old with substantial comorbidities may only last 2 years on dialysis and 4 years with a transplant. So they take the transplant, thank you very much, but the likelihood is 4 or 5 years with even the best transplant. And so a kidney which could have lasted in a younger person for 30 years gets to support somebody for 4 years and then they die.
Yes.
And so socially, morally, it's quite difficult to justify from the perspective of the donating community that that's the right thing to do. From the recipient side, it's about equity, it's about equal access, it's about biological issues of matching and not about social value determinants. But for the donor community, well, it is a bit about ensuring that the best value is derived from every donation. And so we have been struggling for the last 10 years with that issue. It's been debated and discussed by the National Health and Medical Research Council Ethics Committee. And essentially the answer from those discussions is, yeah, look, it's okay to take the donor perspective on this. It's the recipient perspective is not the only perspective that could be right. And so trying now to devise new allocation rules which don't disadvantage the elderly, but also don't waste life years of kidney function. So obviously the strength we have in this country is the ANS data registry. We've got all the data.
Yes.
Not a sample of the data, we've got all of it. Brilliant. And we can therefore analyze all of the data to understand what the impacts are and to model what the changes would be if we made the changes, the allocation system. And so that is one of the things that's going through at the present time. The other thing that's going through is to have a more sophisticated computer system than we currently operate with. The one we currently run was built in 1999. I was responsible for its development at the time, and it was funded on the Y2K bug money. As you remember around
at that certainly
time.
Do.
Y2K, this thing, of course, is littered with dates all the way through it and date calculations. And the year 2000 threw all those calculations into spin if you had a rather unsophisticated computer system.
Indeed.
And I have to say that if I had been absolutely truthful, we could probably have modified the old system to cope for a few more years.
Yep.
But we managed to get a sensible investment in building a new system. And so despite that, we have been constantly renewing it and improving it over time. So it's not the same system as it was in 1999. The fundamental design flexibility that it that we built in then is not quite as good as we could build in today. So a new program is being built today and should be implemented sometime next year. Hopefully, the science of understanding the ethical and moral decision-taking that's appropriate for the community to better allocate organs, to improve the number of life years of both the recipients and the life years of the organ will come together with the computer system capable of running that technology on the fly so that we can do it in the middle of the night and get the answers out and get a better outcome for everybody and to ensure that those decisions remain built into a computer and not into personal preferences of individuals. It's one of the great strengths of this country that the allocation of these organs has been absolutely auditable and has been audited continuously for the last 20 or so years. This is what the computer said we should do. This is what actually happened. Do we understand why it happened? The unspoken issues are around accessing the list, getting onto the waiting list. So what we've talked about to this point is what happens once you're on the waiting list.
Yeah, what are the barriers to getting on that list?
Oh, they're huge. Overall, I think it's only about 15 to 18% of the Australian dialysis population that's on the transplant waiting list. So are the others really not suitable? And then you start splitting it up by age and you go, okay, so I accept that only about 5% of patients over the age 65 are probably safe enough to operate on and will receive benefit, and 0% over the age of 75. And at the other end, most of the young people under the age of 25, they may be on dialysis, but they're actually being worked up for a living donor transplant from somebody in the family. It's in between. And it's not about the problem of being assessed or the will. Some patients don't want to be transplanted. Some patients have had a transplant, it didn't work, they don't want to go back there again. There's a group like that. But there's also a group where a number of tests need to be performed to determine their safety transplant. Usually cardiac tests, sometimes other cancer tests. Sometimes people have had a cancer and they're waiting for a period of time to prove that cancer is not coming back and are safe to transplant. And all those things need tests not done by the renal programs, but performed by other services. Now, access to some of those other services is a bit haphazard in some parts of our country. But those are the sort of issues which are, of course, very variable across the country. So one of the things that's happening at the moment is the state governments and the federal government are looking at, indeed, what are the barriers to accessing the transplant waiting list. Are Aboriginal patients not accessing the list appropriately? Are rural and remote people not accessing? Are people in some communities being held back? Some states, better than others, are getting people onto the transplant waiting list. So that's a process that's going on at the moment, and I think it will come down to examining the resources that are available to the transplant programs. We've had this massive increase in activity, but has not been reflected by a massive increase in workforce. Some of the less immediate things, such as assessing patients for transplant waiting list, are falling a little by the wayside.
Yep.
So if you've got a donor coordinator whose job is to be up all night with a kidney transplant, but it's also to ensure the workup of the living donors, and it's also to ensure that the workup of the patients coming onto the list is done. Well, they've been awake all night, and so the job that they were planning to do during the day isn't quite so easy to do.
So is that what we need more of, donor coordinators, or do we need more of all of them, surgeons,
we need
nurses?
More resources to achieve goals. How each program organises to achieve that will be down to what are the local barriers. But in my view, the pressure that's been put on the transplant programs by the increase in the donation rate and the increase in complexity in those transplants when we do, has not been matched by the increase in resources. And the thing that has gone a little by the wayside in here is to ensure that the access to the waiting list is as effective as the access to transplant once you're on the waiting list.
Is that a funding shortfall, or is it a medical education shortfall?
No, it's a funding shortfall.
Yeah, right.
So the problem is that ambulatory care is essentially underfunded and hasn't been worked up as well as the funding for an in-hospital activity. And so if you have a widget that is a kidney transplant or a coronary artery bypass graft or an episode of pneumonia in hospital, they're pretty well measured and costed in the hospital system and therefore funded in the hospital system. But when you've got 35 people coming to a transplant clinic, it doesn't work. The funding for that doesn't work. And then you place on top of that the need for the outpatient workup of all the donors, living donors, and all of the recipients, and all of the people going onto the transplant waiting list. In a non-funded environment, you start to see some of the barriers. And I'm hoping that governments will address that.
Thanks, Jeremy. Thank you for your time.
Okay, thanks.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.